is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's start first with some education stories, and for that we are turning to Meredith Colias-Pete, who is a reporter for the Post Tribune. Meredith, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, let's talk in particular about last evening with the Lake Central School Corporation asking for public input about the school district finances, and with an eye, I am sure, to putting on the agenda for the May election another school funding referendum. Tell us what came about from last night's meeting, if you will, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Lake Central had a meeting last night at the high school, sort of just to gauge response from the community. It is looking to, in their minds, hopefully place about a $55 million budget referendum on the ballot next May. They're concerned, certainly over the years, about declines in state funding. In about 2009 or so, the state sort of changed the way that school districts are financed, and they kind of shifted that more to income tax and sales tax, giving the school districts options to seek a property tax referendum if they felt that they needed to shore up budgets or kind of see construction projects and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So that's a big reason why you're seeing a lot of school districts that are going to voters lately seeking referendums.
In fact, I think in the first story that you had on making the announcement about the meeting coming up yesterday, the research you had there mentioned that more than a dozen Northwest Indiana school districts have gone that route. They've asked for a referenda, and we know that there have been some successes that have come about most recently earlier this year in the school city of Hobart and in the school city of Hammond. So those apparently have had some, I guess, positive effects on other school districts taking a look at referenda.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've seen in most of those cases that these referendums have passed. There's two persons that come to mind. About November 2016 or so, Gary had put its second referendum on the ballot, and it narrowly failed, I believe, by about less than a percentage point. And then more recently, earlier this year, East Chicago also had a referendum that they put on the ballot that failed. But for the majority of these school districts that have gone to voters sort of asking for tax increases, they've sort of made the argument that they want to maintain teacher salaries and programs and services, and voters have in most cases been willing to do that for them.
So do you get the impression if it does turn out to be that they are going to go to the referendum route that the Lake Central School Corporation is going to go to come back to voters? Is it going to be sometime early in the year or later in the year?
Well, that's a good question. The state requires a certain, advance time to putting a referendum question on the ballot. Lake Central has said that their school board will vote on it next month. Because of the holidays, they don't have any more board meetings for the remainder of the month. So it's expected to be voted on sometime next month. Mm-hmm. And then the goal for them is to put it on the May referendum. And the superintendent, Larry Baracco, did tell me that they are looking to put it on the May ballot because of the sheriff's primary that's also taking place that month. Apparently that they want to put it on an election that they expect that folks will turn out for, have some interest in already going to vote,
okay,
which is a little unusual. I know that Hammond had just had theirs, for example, in November last month, and sometimes school districts tend to sort of roll the dice and put an election on a low turnout election, partially to hope that there's not enough opposition to sort of materialize and organize for such an election. So it is an interesting move on Lake Central's part.
That's true. Staying with Lake Central, I know that you had a story recently in the press, online as well, too, about Lake Central's decision concerning being involved in the area's special education cooperative. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, this has been something that looks like that's been in the works for at least about a year and a half. Since 1972 or so, Lake Central and Munster have sort of pulled resources and provided special education services for their students over at Lake Central. At least since the 90s or so, it looks like that Lake Central has sort of all the administrative infrastructure and staff and things of that nature. It all goes through Lake Central, if that makes sense. But it looks like starting in July 2019 or so that that partnership is going to split off, and Lake Central students will stay at Lake Central, and then the special education students from Munster that were going to Lake Central will now stay at Munster.
Mm-hmm. Do you get the impression that, that those school districts are going to set up their own programs, or if they haven't already, they're planning to do so?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these, it's important to remember that these are federally mandated services for special education children. So Lake Central, the director, you know, basically said Lake Central has been running the show for, you know, 20 years or so. And so it's not probably not that much impact over there. But there's a few programs here and there that Munster will have to develop in the coming years.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other communities that are maybe looking to do the same sort of thing and getting away from this special education cooperative?
It looks like only two districts were a part of this cooperative, so I'm not sure, to be honest with you, but this was something very specific to Munster Lake Central.
Okay. One of the other stories that you also covered for the Post Tribune that you can check out online as well as in print deals with the sad story of, I guess, the status of a Lake Central High School teacher who had gotten caught on video administering drugs to herself in a classroom. Tell us what the latest is about this young lady.
Yes, absolutely. This was an arrest that happened at Lake Central High School the day before Thanksgiving, of course. What had happened is it looks like students had been standing outside of the door of an English teacher, and her name was Samantha Cox. She's about 24 years old or so. And it appeared to them while they were filming her on cell phones that she appeared to be snorting drugs inside of her classroom. They were sort of looking through a window while she was doing this. She was promptly arrested, and she's currently charged in court with possession of cocaine and possession of paraphernalia as well. So her employment status at Lake Central is currently under review at this point. The superintendent has said that that's something that they're continuing to investigate. Mm-hmm. Ms. Cox, of course, made her first court appearance, which we covered in the paper earlier this week on Monday.
Mm-hmm. One other story, too, that you had covered as well was in the latest information here from the Gary Maternal Child Health Clinic. And I think maybe many people may have not even been aware that it was open, but it's been open for a very long time compared to some other clinics of its type around Northwest Indiana and probably even the state. But I understand that this one particular clinic in Gary is about to close.
Yes, absolutely. And this particular clinic has been around in various sort of incarnations in various locations in the city since about 1976. It's, you know, managed to survive over these years. And, you know, the purpose for it really was to serve first low-income children and then low-income mothers as well. This was, you know, a clinic itself, the Maternal Child Health Clinic, that was very proud of the wraparound services that you provided to its patients. For example, you know, if you were a low-income mother looking to get care for your children, you know, you would go in there and they would check to see your child's immunization history, you know, kind of get a sense on what was going on in their lives. And and they also had the social work on staff to sort of make sure that they were able to sort of get benefits that would be necessary for the children as well. It looks like, unfortunately, in this past year, about August or so, they were notified that they were not going to receive a $50,000 grant from the state. The city of Gary as well matched that grant, so you had about $100,000 that sort of evaporated. The director has said since the summer that they really had been checking around just to see how they could secure additional funding, but of course, unfortunately, it looks like too big of a budget hole for them to patch in such short time.
How long has this clinic been open? Found out from these folks?
Well, it's moved around the city a few times. So it's been open for more than 40 years, so about 41 years. And
wow.
Of course, you would imagine for a clinic being open that for that long period of time, that you had, you know, multiple generations in there. I mean, I spoke to one woman yesterday. They sort of had a going away party at the clinic where she had gone as a baby for her own immunization shots. And then when she became pregnant as a teenager, she kind of just lived on the street and, you know, went back there for care for her own children. And so staff really described it sort of as a close-knit, very family, you know, a very family-oriented environment. And What was sort of remarkable as well is that the staff, the doctors and such there, social workers, had been there for multiple years. I mean, a receptionist who had worked there for 33 years, for example. One of their pediatricians had worked there from the day that it opened, that he was, you know, pitching in all these years. That in itself means that, you know, of course, the pediatrician would have seen multiple generations of patients.
We're talking with Meredith Kolias-Pete, who's a reporter covering education news these days for the Northwest Indiana Post-Tribune. And Meredith, thank you for spending some time with us to talk about the stories that you had. And we'll look forward to some other updates on some other things as well over in the time to come here. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you as well. Merry Christmas.
And thank you. Same to you, too. This is Regionally Speaking's Reporter Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. And once again, we're turning to our colleague, Carrie Napoleon, who takes care of stories for the Post-Tribune. Carrie's with us. Thanks for being with us today.
Good afternoon, Chris.
Well, I hope that some interesting things have come out here, certainly from Lake County government and the other governments that you cover as well, too. Let's get right in here to the one that you've story that you've worked on involving the Lake County Police Union. I guess there was a contract that was up for approval or renewal or whatever recently.
Yes, it's the 3-year contract. Mm-hmm. So it expires December 31st, and it was approved on Tuesday. They talked about it in their workshop on Thursday. And it had been ratified by the union overwhelmingly, according to union president Dan Merchek, and the council ratified it unanimously on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. What was the union asking for from the sheriff's department as part of this new agreement?
The big thing was salary. Of course, you know, as Dan said, it's never as much as you'd like it to be, but they did secure a 3% a year raise for the next 3 years for the police officers.
Mm-hmm. Does it turn out that membership seemed to really push for this or a pay raise this time?
You know, no more than every time. Okay. You know, again, they are among some of the lowest paid in the area as far as officers go. So trying to get them up to a, you know, especially the starting guys up to a better salary has always been an issue.
And I know that from your experience as well, too, that the sheriffs and deputies that are on the road are the ones that are sometimes the busiest, and they end up carrying the various varieties of calls. I guess it can range from just a simple thing that maybe a resident happens to have a problem with to a serious crime of some type or a serious accident. So they probably get the myriad of calls, and they probably feel like they need it.
Exactly. I mean, in Lake County, you can get anything from a rabid animal call out in the rural area to, like you said, a homicide. You just don't know what kind of things you're going to encounter.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully they will get what they need, and with luck, they've got a good contract to work with, and they will have over the next year or so. One of the other stories that you covered as well, too, was dealing with, I guess, talking about the very serious situation that involved family members of a famous coach, Marvin Ray Sr. And you were able to catch the memorial service, I guess, for Mr. Ray recently here. Tell us about that.
The service was a really nice service. There were hundreds of people that came through that day. It was a very nice service. He was clearly a beloved man. There were a lot of people that he had mentored over the years there. Just a lot of support for him and for his family and his children that he's left behind.
Mm-hmm. I know that you did not cover the original story here much, and certainly not from the sports angle of it here, too, but I'm sure you had a chance to look at some of the information about it before you went to the memorial service. Tell us, if you can, a little bit about Marvin Ray and this fella and how, I guess, the reason that a lot of people seem to look up to him, not only as a great coach, but as a great person as well, too.
Well, you know, he is a born and raised Gary native. You know, he's a graduate of Roosevelt High School, 1987. Many of his classmates were there. He's just spent a lot of time in the community. He coached at Roosevelt, then went on to Thea Bowman and brought 2 championships to Thea Bowman before he was let go under some contested circumstances regarding some uniform payments, and then went on to Lighthouse this year. He was really credited with doing a lot with the program over in Thea Bowman and just raising it up in a short period of time.
I know that our sports guy, Tommy Williams, was very, very concerned about this. He had, I guess, close connection with the coach of one of the sports angle for many years, and he was very, I guess, a bit distraught as well, too, to hear this. It's just these things happen, and it's sad to say, and there's sometimes the impact is very wide, like in this case with the Ray family and Mr. Ray himself, and certainly our condolences going out to the family for the loss that they have and this as well, too. One of the other stories, Kerry, that I know you covered as well too for the Post Tribune was an update here that came out of Crown Point here that a child's learning center project that was being built in downtown Crown Point is not going to get the property tax abatement that they had sought. Give us the details about the project and why it's not going to get through like I thought.
Well, the project has been in the planning stages for over a year. They were eyeing the Hallmark property on the corner of Summit and Main Street. And, you know, they have a tentative deal on that property. And what they're putting there is a kiddie academy, which is not a daycare center. It's actually an accredited school. There will be 27 accredited teachers there. But it's not a private school, so it is a taxable property.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, in the planning process, they discovered they needed a little more land and had to expand what they were buying. The original project was expected to cost around $2 million. And with the expanded land that they needed to acquire to put different entrances on and some drainage issues that they brought to the attention of the city, the project price went up, and they decided to ask for the abatement for a little help. I don't know if originally they were going to, but they hadn't up until that point requested an abatement from the city until the extra expenses came on.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you know what the next steps are going to be for the folks that wanted to put in this Children's Learning Center?
You know, they are looking at their options. Nothing has been firmly decided yet, but I don't believe this is quite over. I think they're hoping to look at their options and maybe try and work with the city, maybe explain their situation a little better and get one of the council members to reintroduce it. They are looking at what they can do.
I know that the city of Crown Point has been working very hard to find a tenant for this building. This building, by the way, if you're not aware of it, used to be a Hallmark store. And after the store closed, it's been sitting vacant for a number of years, I understand. And I guess the city really has worked very hard to find a tenant for the building.
They really have. And, you know, it was strange because this is one of the only tax abatements since my time covering it. And according to Mayor Uran, during his 10 years so far as mayor, mm-hmm. that has been denied. So, you know, the reasoning behind it was, you know, it was a little surprising to see it get denied. You know, we weren't necessarily expecting that.
Well, hopefully that they'll get reconsidered, and maybe the city council will take this back up again in the meantime. Kerry Napoleon covers, in this case, the story for Crown Point and other news in Lake County for the Post Tribune. And as always, Kerry, thank you for spending time with us today to talk about your stories here on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you, and have a happy holidays
thank
and all
you.
Your listeners.
Thank you. Same to you. As America confronts the opioid crisis, environmental scientists are very concerned about a related problem. Chemicals from painkillers and other drugs sometimes end up in the Great Lakes and the surrounding waters, and that includes the Great Lakes in our part of the state. And that may also create a very dangerous cocktail for fish and other wildlife in the regions that are affected. Great Lakes Today's Angelica Morrison talks about the fight to keep the waters of the Great Lakes clean.
The war on drugs has moved from households to the outdoors.
What we use in our everyday lives goes down the drain and ends up somewhere. It just does.
That's Emma Rosie, an expert in aquatic ecosystems for the Cary Institute. It's a research group located north of New York City. Her team studies a long trail of chemicals from opioids, antidepressants, and even illicit drugs like cocaine. They get into the ecosystem through human urine and feces, and sometimes unused medications get flushed down toilets and drains. From there, they eventually reach streams, lakes, and rivers.
Anything that people are using in their everyday lives. And so when we think about the opioid crisis, which is has a huge impact on people's lives, there's another side of it, which is that those drugs that people use are ending up in their waste stream and getting out into the environment as well, with unknown ecological consequences.
It's a problem across the Great Lakes region. Researchers have found caffeine in waters in Northwest Ohio and nicotine in Lake Michigan. Pharmaceuticals, personal care products, along with other compounds, have been found in the Calumet River in Illinois and the Fox River in Wisconsin. In the Niagara River, which leads to Niagara Falls, elevated levels of antidepressants were found in fish brains. Alicia Perez Fuente Taha is one of the researchers who worked on the project. She's from the Great Lakes Center at Buffalo State College. She says these chemicals are designed to affect human behavior, and fish could be affected as well.
People ask me, oh, are they happy? It's like, no, I don't think antidepressants make people happy either. I think the people don't care so much about things, and that's exactly what they do to fish.
Perez Fuente Taha says fish could become less aware of the risks around them and therefore expose themselves to dangers. They could also become disinterested in reproducing or eating.
And they're exposed to this cocktail 24/7. So a person can be on or off their medications. The fish are always on.
Now, Rosie's research has a different aim. It shows that compounds from amphetamines and other biologically active drugs could cause aquatic insects to emerge sooner, giving them an extended life cycle. Keeping these compounds out of the environment has become a priority for some communities. In the Buffalo area, for example, there are dozens of drop-off sites for unused drugs. They're taken to a central facility, and there, machines grab large barrels of discarded drugs, which are then burned and used for energy. County Health Commissioner Gail Burstein says this process helps keep Lake Erie and other waterways clean and clear.
This is trying to be as green as possible and to help prevent these drugs getting into our water system or getting into our soil and then leaching out into the water system. And as you know, that water treatment plants, their filtration system cannot rid us of all the pharmaceuticals that are flushed down the drain or flushed down the toilets.
Burstein says these drop-off sites allow anyone to help keep drugs out of the Great Lakes ecosystem. For Great Lakes Today, this is Angelica Morrison.
By the way, here in Northwest Indiana, if you do have a discardable medication of that type that Angelica was talking about in her report, you can check in with your local police department and see if they have a drop-off location there. Many of the community police departments do have barrels or boxes where in turn that they will accept discarded medications and they'll be properly disposed of. Great Lakes Today is a collaboration of WBFO Public Radio in Buffalo, IdeaStream Cleveland, and WXXI Public Radio in Rochester. And for more stories, just go to greatlakestoday.org. This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and without being too flippant, I guess you could say we now turn to the continuing saga of Jamal Washington. And for that, we have to turn to the fellow who gets the chance to sit at the county council meetings and watch and listen to him as he's at the county government center. In this case, he's talking about all the problems that that Mr. Washington is facing in court these days. Bill Dolan covers county government, as he always does, for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Bill, thank you for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's begin at the beginning, as they say here. Tell us a little bit about what Jamal Washington seems to have gotten himself into.
Well, he was arrested last Friday. The allegation is that a female cousin who was living in his house for several months by the name of Camaria Buckley apparently got into some kind of a verbal dispute. Mm-hmm. That ended up with a broken cell phone and her claiming that he had pushed her to the floor and throttled her and that he had threatened her with a hammer. But Ms. Buckley later told the Times that she made that up. It was a fabrication. She was mad at him, and she called the police, and now she wishes the world to know that she wasn't harmed in any way.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, the prosecutor's office, the police arrested him when he came in for questioning on Friday, and the prosecutors has charged him with a number of felonies and misdemeanors, battery, confinement, and other associated matters. And as I speak to you, he sits in the Lake County Jail, unable to post bond until the day after Christmas, because he is also facing a revocation of his probation for his earlier 2015 assault, battery on his wife. Mm-hmm. And he's in a mess of trouble.
I guess I could say that that's definitely the best way to put it, I suppose. From what you had in your research and the information you've had a chance to check out in the court records and all, what can you tell us about Ms. Buckley?
Well, she told us, and I believe the police, that she was born and raised in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. had become homeless there, and moved in with Mr. Washington maybe 3 months before. That's what she said. It's not entirely clear when, but regardless. She got a job with the Lake County E911 service, which is in Crown Point. I have spoken with the E91 director, who said that Mr. Washington did in fact ask whether there was a job opening for her, and did drive her to the job interview, but that she passed all the tests and qualified to be a dispatcher. E911 is the communications network for most police, fire, and emergency medical services in the county. Mm-hmm. And she's a full-time dispatcher in training there as we speak.
And I know that you had an accompanying story about this as well, too, this week in the Times, talking about the information as to, I guess, the way that Ms. Buckley had managed to get her job. She did get it fair and square, I guess you could say. She passed all the tests and she was qualified. But that, I think it brought the question up as to whether someone like a county councilman like Jawan Washington could actually have some kind of influence on people that might be seeking county government jobs.
Well, he according to the present director, Mark Swiderski, and the past director, Brian Hitchcock, Mr. Washington has introduced a number of people, more than 20, to apply for jobs with 911. Tom Daverton, who's the human resources consultant for county government, said there's certainly nothing wrong with an elected official encouraging someone to be hired, but of course he can't. There can be no threats or promises associated with that.
Yeah.
Mr. Swiderski said that Ms. Buckley was qualified, and he had to put aside second thoughts about whether or not this should be done because of her relationship with Mr. Washington, and she's currently working there.
Now, this brings up, of course, an accompanying story as well, too, here, the reaction, I guess, from Mr. Washington's colleagues on the Lake County Council to what has happened, the problems that he's facing, and the fact that he's now sitting in jail, at least for the time being. And certainly the county council wasn't going to just be reactive. They're trying to be proactive in taking some action this week. Tell us about that.
Well, they've privately expressed disappointment in this latest turn of events. And on Tuesday, their last public meeting of the of this year, mm-hmm. They stripped him of all what are called committee assignments. Each department has its own committee of three county councilmen who sit over their financial matters. If an elected official needs to spend money on some new thing or move money around in his budget, he has to get the council's approval, and the first step in that process is meeting with the committee. So a committee member can have is in a position to have influence over or not whether an elected official can do what they want to do, will have the money to do what they want to do,
right.
Should say. Mm-hmm. And the Lake County Council president, Ted Bilski, announced late in the meeting Tuesday that to avoid any appearance of a conflict or impropriety, that we're going to remove Mr. Washington from any committee assignments that has to do with the courts or with law enforcement. That includes the Sheriff's Department, the jail, the Community Corrections Program, which is a minimum security facility for people who've been convicted of state crimes, and a couple of courts and associated law enforcement agencies like the prosecutor's office. They don't want Mr. Washington to have anything to do with those while these current charges are pending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just mentioned, and you mentioned this too in your story about the county council's vote on this, that, that they're not only personally concerned, but they're also concerned, I guess, for other county governmental agencies that you say that might have some contact with the Councilman Washington, mainly because they're just, you know, they're maybe afraid that there might be some influence or some somebody he'll get upset and he'll say, no, you're not getting any more money or
Miss Buckley, the victim, the alleged victim in this case, told police last week that she was reluctant initially to come forward because she felt that Mr. Washington might retaliate against her. Her being newly hired at the 911.
Yeah.
And again, Mr. Dabberton said that that would clearly be not only unethical but illegal to retaliate against someone for reporting a crime.
Okay. We're talking with Bill Dolan, who is a county government reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and we're focusing on Regionally Speaking Reporters Roundtable Thursday about the charges, the incident, and the charges against Lake County Councilman Jamal Washington, and the fallout from all of this. You mentioned here in particular what the county council as a whole, with Mr. Washington absent, sitting unfortunately in jail at the time, had to do. What are they going to look to in the future? Is there anything that they feel they can do in the future?
Well, they can't kick him off the county council. Mr. Washington was elected by the voters, and only the voters or the courts could remove Mr. Washington from office.
Mm-hmm.
So what they say essentially is, we've done everything we can do. It's up to those others if they don't want it. Now, I should quickly add that Mr. Washington had announced back in October that he does not intend to run for re-election on the county council. He intends to run as a candidate for county clerk.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to make for a number of people who are running for that in the Democratic Party primary coming up here. We know that one of them already has expressed a very interested in the that particular spot is soon to be at least retiring State Representative Charlie Brown, among other people. There are a number of people, I guess, that have even now before the candidates have even gone to file official paperwork that a lot of people said that they're interested in the job.
Mr. Brown has said that he is interested in the job. Filing doesn't begin until January, and they have until February, so there is plenty of time for many people to join in that.
Yeah.
And I should tell your listeners that if they keep tuned to the Times, columnist Mark Chase will be writing about this very subject of what the county council can do in terms of Mr. Washington in the future, and whether or not they can in fact remove him from the council or not.
Yeah,
there is a law. There is some precedent in the East Chicago City Council case where City Councilman Robert Battle was removed. He too is in jail. Former City Councilman Robert Battle. He is sitting in jail awaiting trial on a homicide charge.
Right.
In a completely unrelated matter.
Yeah. And one of the other opportunities, then, when you were putting your stories together, more than one, certainly, for the Times this week about Jamal Washington, was getting some reaction from the two political party leaders. Tell us first what Jim Weiser, who is the chairman of Mr. Washington's own party, and the opposition, so to speak, Dan Durnell, had to say.
Jim Weiser is the chairman of the Lake County Democratic Party, and of course, Mr. Washington is a Democrat. And I believe Mr. Weiser immediately issued a press release, which if it hasn't already, will soon appear as a guest column in the Times, mm-hmm. Calling for Mr. Washington to resign, that the party cannot tolerate this kind of behavior, and he should do what's best for the party and the public. Dan Durnell, who's the chairman of the Lake County Republican Party, this week echoed that and said that it is time that Mr. Washington must step down. He wasn't speaking as a county councilman. He also is a county councilman, but speaking as a leader of the Republican Party, he too believes that Mr. Washington should step down and let someone else take over that position.
Okay. Now, Bill, we know that finally we have had an opportunity to find out through your stories just today about what Mr. Jamal Washington has to say about all this. You had an opportunity to speak with Mr. Washington. Sad to say, he was still at the Lake County Jail, but tell us about the phone conversation that you had with him and what you learned in that and how this conversation came about.
Well, he wants his constituents and the public to know that he considers himself innocent, 100% innocent, he said, and that he will not resign and that he will fight this, and that he also released a video taken from his cell phone during this dispute that's at the center of these charges, in which you see a young lady who is Camaria Buckley accusing Mr. Washington of assaulting her, mm-hmm. and Mr. Washington telling her that she has to leave his house. Mr. Washington says he feels that that's proof that he did not confine her. He is charged with confining her, keeping her against her will, and he said this video should prove that he did not confine her. On the contrary, he was trying to eject her from the house.
Now, how did you get the opportunity to have a chance to talk with Mr. Washington, seeing as he's locked up in jail?
All inmates in the Lake County Jail have telephone privileges and have had them for many decades. And one of those contacts that he has is Gary City Councilwoman LaVita Sparks Wade. Mm-hmm. Mr. Washington and Ms. Sparks Wade have been conducting a number of Facebook Live broadcasts to their constituents about local politics. And Ms. Sparks Wade called and said that Mr. Washington wanted to speak to us. And the next thing you know, I'm talking to him.
Do you have a chance to see that video, I guess? Are you going to be able to pass that on to readers?
The video is available at NWI.com if your listeners would like to view it itself. And it lasts a couple minutes. And apparently he felt that this video, which was presented to the police and the prosecutor, would exonerate him of any allegations. But, of course, they have... did not come to that conclusion. They're pressing ahead. And I should quickly add that a special prosecutor has been named, a gentleman by the name of Stanley Levko, who's an attorney in Evansville and I believe a former prosecutor. This was brought in as well 2 years ago when Mr. Washington was first charged on the similar grounds that because of his position on the county council and county finances, there should be no influence on either the prosecution or the judge who would have to hear the criminal cases against Mr. Washington.
Right. Well, we know that the other case that had been involving Mr. Washington, end up in Porter County. I have to find it even further county away to be able to have this latest one.
It will likely remain in Porter County. The case is filed actually in Lake County courts, but again, because of the fear of a conflict, the venue has been removed to the next county in Porter County. I believe it's actually the Porter County's office in the city of Portage. Mm-hmm. And a special prosecutor has been named, and I expect a special judge will also be named to not only hear the new charges, but whether Mr. Washington has violated the terms of his probation from the previous case.
Yeah, that's the question I'm sure that's definitely going to come up, because I know that you mentioned in your story earlier during the initial hearing, the question came up from the magistrate to Mr. Washington about what his involvement in that case that's now over in Porter County, that he seemed to have forgotten about that one.
Well, that could be a very dangerous situation for him. He received a suspended one-year sentence in that case, and if he is found to be in violation of his probation, the judge could order him to serve any portion of that one-year sentence, which, of course, would be he might be in jail a lot longer than his current term.
That's true. We've been talking about the problems surrounding Lake County Councilman Jamal Washington and telling us all about the latest involving the courts, as well as what's happening with Mr. Washington himself. We've had Bill Dolan, who covers county government for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Bill, thank you very much for the update. We appreciate it. And we know that, as you said, we'll stay tuned, because we'll find out more in the days and weeks ahead here involving all of this as well, too. And we appreciate you spending time with us to talk about it today, Bill.
Thank you for having me.
You're entirely welcome. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Star Wars: The Last Jedi is coming out on December 14th. And on opening night, fans of all ages will often wear costumes dressing up as their favorite Star Wars characters. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Ben Clemmer had a chance to talk with some members of the Northern Darkness Garrison, which is located in Indiana, and is one part of a much larger group that specializes in costumes from a galaxy far, far away.
The 501st Legion is an all-volunteer organization that brings Star Wars costume enthusiasts together under one name. 501st Legion members dressed as stormtroopers at San Diego Comic-Con are part of the same organization as those in Indiana. Not only is Indiana home to a 501st garrison, a group must have at least 20 active Legion members to be considered a garrison, the Northern Darkness Garrison currently has 66 Legion members in the northernmost 22 counties in the state.
My name is Mark Reiner, doing Director Krennic right now with the Northern Darkness Garrison and the 501st Legion.
I spoke with Mark Reiner at the Sci-Fi Central event held in Fort Wayne this fall. He was dressed as Director Krennic, a villain from Rogue One, a Star Wars story. He told me about the many different events the 501st will attend, more often than not helping to raise money for charities.
Libraries, schools, all kinds of events, anything that's charitable, it's almost 100% that we'll do it.
One of the Northern Darkness Garrison's most regular partners is the Make-A-Wish Foundation, and the Garrison will partner with local charities throughout northern Indiana. But what goes into joining the 501st Legion? For starters, there are building instructions on the 501st website for each of the hundreds of costumes that have been approved for Legion use.
You follow those instructions, put the costume together, and I happen to be the one in Northern Darkness. You send me pictures, I'll compare it to the CRL.
That's the Costume Reference Library. Potential Legion members in Northern Indiana send the pictures of their costume to Reiner, and there are plenty of comparisons to be made before approval. Each costume in the CRL is laid out in incredible detail. If you want to dress as Director Krennic, you need to know whether the buttons on the top of his rank badge are red or blue. If you want to dress as Captain Phasma, you need to know which costume components are silver and which are black. If you plan to dress up as Darth Vader, which movie costume are you using? Each one is just a little different from the others. While Darth Vader is arguably the most iconic villain in cinema history, the costume specifications available in the CRL aren't just limited to the live-action films.
My name's Courtney Smith. I costume as today Mara Jade, who is the Emperor's hand.
Smith's costume fits the description of Mara Jade from Star Wars novels. Jade first appeared in 1991 and now is viewed as the prototype for the modern female central characters in the Star Wars franchise, Rey from Episodes 7 and 8, and Jyn Erso from Rogue One, A Star Wars Story.
My costume has two different versions. Like, I can wear a cape, but right now, since my hair's not red, I'm going with the hood.
Each costume presents challenges. Smith's Mara Jade costume hides her hair, but her face is completely visible. Few Legion members have that luxury. A scout trooper from Return of the Jedi explains that the Empire likely lost so many battles because he can't see anything lower than his nose. Despite a likely visual impairment, Legion members still put in the time to make the costumes. Here's Smith translating for a Legion member whose voice was muffled by his mask.
How many hours do you have in that?
Months.
Months. 4 months.
The costume took 4 months to build. The Frequently Asked Questions section of the 501st website says inside the costumes it can be hotter than the desert planet Tatooine in summertime. The Northern Darkness Garrison members push through that potential discomfort to devote their efforts to charity. Sometimes an event comes up that offers Legion members a unique opportunity. The 501st has many honorary members and friends of the Legion, including one specific parody artist with a couple Star Wars songs in his catalog. Weird Al Yankovic performs his songs The Saga Begins and Yoda with his band flanked by members of the 501st Legion dressed as Darth Vader and Stormtroopers. The premiere of a new Star Wars movie is arguably the worst time to try to spot a member of the 501st Legion. Everyone and their mother could be wearing a costume, but the next time you are at an event, perhaps one raising money for charity, you just might see Darth Vader flanked by white armored Stormtroopers, and they just might be members of the 501st Legion. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Ben Clemmer.
I'd be remiss if I didn't let some John Williams music pass through. You can find out more information about the 501st Legion at 501st, that's the number 1st.com, for more information about the Northern Indiana Group. And you can find out more information about the Northern Darkness Garrison at n-dgarrison.com, as well as their page, which is also on Facebook. Our many thanks to the folks who have been joining us for the Regionally Speaking Reporters Roundtable Wrap-Up. From the Times, Bill Dolan, and from the Post-Tribune, Meredith Coleus-Pete, and Carrie Napoleon. And thank you for being with us on the program as well. We'll be back with you on Monday.